Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger in the Heartland, in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to drink and sometimes eat. Evil!
And you've got that right. You've got that right, right here on January 22nd, 2014. Yeah, Wotan's Day, Dave Lane's favorite day. And we're at P.O. Box 401, still there. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's not Warsaw, Poland. Okay, that's Warsaw, Indiana. Yeah. Count Kosciuszko got a big land grant from Washington because he helped General Washington in the Revolutionary War. So he gave him a big frontier land grant, Count Kosciuszko. He was one of the best friends that Washington had, too. Anyhow, that's where you send your donations and for everything. And I think you've got this little appeal that I sent out this morning that was sent to me by Ms. Hutchison, Matt Hale's mother. So I promised I'd send those out, so you've got them in your email. And I reminded her that some of our people had been contributing to Matt Hale from time to time already. Don't forget that idea of using postcards and sending little just thoughts of the day or whatever you want to say into these inmates. It's very cheap. I think it's 37 cents for a postcard. You know, when I was a kid, they were penny postcards. That gives you an idea how old I am. Still, that's the easiest way to communicate. And like I said the other day, I'll type something out on my processor or on the internet, on the computer, and then print it out and trim off the edges and paste it on the back of a postcard. Then you can write a regular letter on a postcard. How about that? A printed letter. The neat part about that is that sometimes you want the system to know what is on the card. Because it's a two-way street. It's a two-edged sword. Sometimes I want them to read what I'm sending. For different reasons sometimes, you know. Especially we want to know the system to know that we care about our fallen comrades. And that's the main thing. I just got a copy of the appeal that Dennis Mahan's attorney has filed with the court yesterday, and I had a chance to read it. And from what I can see, it looks very much like that Dennis was not guilty of the charges they made against him. He was, from this appeal, it was obviously how he was targeted. For 5 years, they were targeting him, and they had an informant next to him, this gal. He made a lot of mistakes, but still, it was the government trying to zero in on him. They used every trick in the book. And so this gal was hanging around for about 5 years, finally getting enough that she thought she could make it fly. But in reading the appeal, there was a whole lot of objections and material that didn't get into the trial, that the judge wouldn't let in, that would have shown that very possibly that Dennis Mahone was totally innocent in that situation, other than being dumb around this informant. Now, the one thing that's really, really strange about this case is, I was talking to his brother briefly, Danny, And here's Danny charged with the same charges. Same charges that Dennis was charged with. And they let him go scot-free. In fact, he was shocked himself when they came down and said, you know, not guilty, or whatever they said, and said, you're out of here. He was shocked too, because how can you charge two men with the same charges and both know each other and go almost every place together and then leave one loose and hammer the other one? That don't make sense. It just doesn't make any sense at all. I'm glad for Danny that he didn't get hammered and sent to prison. But it's just strange. Danny says all that time he was urging and cajoling Dennis to break it off with that woman. He could almost see what was coming. He could see what she was trying to do. But here was his brother trying to get him to break off with her and tell her to go on down the road. But by that time, evidently, he was into the alcohol way too much. He was drinking that Everclear, and that's like white lightning. And he drank too much, and when you lose your ability to be a rational thinker and use common sense and let a woman, which a woman can pretty easily do, screw up a man and vice versa, things go downhill. It's too bad. I understand that when the ATF raided the parents' home of Dennis and Daniel Mahon, they just ripped that place apart. It just tore everything to pieces, broke up furniture, everything. And so Danny evidently has been out there from time to time trying to put it all back together, because during this trial his mother passed away and his father's very old, very sick and senile, and he's in a home. But that ATF, they're just a bunch of goons with badges. There's no other description I can give of those guys. They are, a lot of them are hired criminals. I mean, they've been caught doing criminal activity, and then they hire them to work for the government. They let them off of the charge. And I know that's true, because I knew some of those guys, or at least a couple of them. Okay. Well, it's just about time for another short class here in the old schoolroom. Okay, get in there out of the playground, boys and girls. It's time for class. Even my dog responds to that. No matter how one cuts it, there are but three steps which must be followed towards revolution. Successful revolution. These are resist, revolt, and rule. In the first, one finds oneself disillusioned, alienated, then becoming more aware. Got to change the page here. More aware and intelligent of his circumstances. He enters the movement, the struggle, and perhaps becomes further alienated. But if he has the stuff within him, he becomes hardened and agile. He gains instinct, and he begins the course of education, agitate, and organize. Or get himself organized, at least. In the second step, he has learned that he must strike quickly, hard, and decisively. He takes care to see that there can be no turning back. Compromise has long since been discarded. He has in the forefront of his thoughts the awareness that only the most determined and most radical can hope to master the situation ultimately. In the final step, he harbors no regrets. He puts an end to his opposition. He sees that the drastic measures called for will, for a time, result in more simplistic society, but one vastly more just and healthy than before. He joyfully accepts the task. He establishes the new order. White men will never rule their own lives and destinies again without a successful revolt. And no revolt can materialize without its intensive period of resistance, the basic preparatory stage of the revolutionary movement's development. Attempting to revolt now would be suicidal, while attempting to rule at present through compromise by trying to win a local election is rather a whimsical dream. We must first successfully resist, which entails pulling ourselves together, getting up on our feet, and ceasing to roll with the blows. It means having enough organization to be able to call a number of shots felt directly on a national, if not world, scale on our own. It means mounting a series of national socialist or white victories. It amounts to a coming age and becoming truly the struggle to do the job. The trick or the key to this is nothing so new. Off and on in recent past, we've seen it almost done by one or another struggle grouping or leader. But what has been missing and what now must be fulfilled is a movement or a struggle functioning and acting in unison, maintaining, increasing, bringing into focus, and bearing its full strength as it is called for. A team, a network, a syndicate, an effective political entity. To become functional and effective is the phase we must achieve. There are no others. Never have I been a user of Commander Rockwell's four phases, because I am sure that the concept became obsolete soon after his death. I would rather give it a decent burial as a good idea that might have worked in its time, instead of going on like others, abusing it as a double talk term, as an excuse for introversion and wheel spinning. The Fakers are stuck in phase two, right where Commander Rockwell died, and there they shall always remain. The NSLF will not subscribe to an outdated strategy. Rather, we must come to realize that the only correct strategy is that which is dictated to us by reality. It may sound easy, but the proviso is, have we got the will, determination, and courage to selflessly follow these sometimes harsh dictates? And that's the end of our class for today from the great book, Siege, by James Mason. He was very much a visionary. Still alive someplace. I don't know where he's at. But it's a great book. You should read it. Should get it. Keep it with your more important books.
Arians down here from Georgia. We call your network all the time and listen to the radio show. You know, we're interested in getting in touch with you and just, you know, spreading the Arian spirit. You know, we're still living it and spreading it down here in Georgia, but it's a dime a dozen where we're from. You know, white folks, just they've got the wrong idea down here, and we're trying all we can try, brother. But just one day,
Chicago. We've talked before. You know, right now I'm living in a fucking building that I can't get out of because they got some kind of fucking situation in Chicago where once again the gangs are running around like animals. I can't even leave my apartment building because there's a SWAT team. There's two SWAT teams, like 20 police cars, 20 detective cars, news crews and everything. And it's pretty sad the way Chicago is. So I'm kind of sliding you a secret message that, you know, whatever the lone wolves do, they need to really step it up in Chicago. Like I say, you know, I'm sliding you this message in secret. I'm not going to leave, you know, my name or any name of any person I know, but this really fucking sucks. You know, I heard last night on TV that they call Chicago the land of savages. That's its nickname in the nation. And I can believe that because here I am, you know, a good person. My parents have always been taxpaying citizens. You know, we've always been good people, and we have to suffer, you know, because fucking thugs don't know how to act. You know, and like I say, I know a couple people in Chicago that work for, you know, our cause, but there needs to be, like, more out in Chicago. It seems like every person in Chicago is afraid to get involved in the solution because they don't want to be labeled, quote, racist. They don't want to be labeled a hate monger. But, you know, I've got friends in Chicago that just went in the last 5 years. I know four good friends of mine that got fucking murdered. And I even know a person who became the victim of the knockout game in New York City. You know, somebody that I email, and it's getting fucking disgusting. It's getting to the fucking point where, you know, our people got to fucking wake up, because I'm in a building that the police are telling me I can't walk out of because it's not safe.
Now, don't forget our new message line, our national message line, which is 559-670-1473, and I change that message every few days. Also, another line, 641-715-3800, then press in 56890#. And you'll get the message, and make sure you leave a message. I get a hell of a lot of calls coming in, but very few people leaving messages. I had a few papers. In fact, I had quite a number of the remaining papers, the war papers, shipped out to me from California, and I now have them in the bunker. And we've got quite a stack of them, quite a number of cases of them. We're getting more people that are asking for the old newspapers. And you might spread it around, or even for yourself, that we're selling these at $2 a piece, $2 donation for a newspaper. Now, these papers have great articles in them, unbelievable, that goes back years and years. Now, you can take one of these papers and cut these articles out, and you can photocopy them and use them to hand out to people or send to people like that. Because I'm telling you, these newspapers are full of great articles, and it's not good to waste them. People are always asking for articles and more information and something to give to other people. Well, that's a perfect thing, because you can get several articles, several paste-ups out of one issue of the paper, and then just cut them out, take them down, photocopy them, and give them out to your friends. In fact, I just got a call from a lady from San Jose, California. She didn't have a computer or anything, but she wanted the information. So I said, well, I'll send you a sample of our newspaper that we don't publish anymore, but we've got a tremendous amount of them here. So we'll send you one. And it's a good educational tool, because there's none of those papers were ever put out that didn't have great articles in it. We had some really good writers. So it sort of reminds us there's some people out there that still don't have a computer. And she didn't sound like a dummy either. She sounded like she just didn't want to have all that stuff. And sometimes I can understand just exactly how she feels. Here's an interesting a piece out of the British papers from a Jew who's bemoaning the fact that everybody's picking on us poor Jews. But you can get a lot of information right direct from the horse's mouth, I think. That's where I like to get it. I don't like Alex Jones interpreting things for me. British Jews who care about this sort of thing have had the disturbing experience of observing not one but three examples of public, homegrown, anti-Jewish bigotry over the past few days. Interesting enough, this Jew uses the term anti-Jew instead of anti-Semitic. Well, I respect the person for that. First off the block was the former Labor Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, who in an article in The Independent repeated not only his inexplicable belief that his idol, Iran's President Rouhani, was ushering in a new world order of peace and harmony, but also that the benighted Israelis were buying up Washington in order to frustrate this nirvana. I paraphrase, but you get the general idea. Well, they are. All these hawkish congressmen and senators, all these pro-Zionists in Washington, that's all you can hear them talking about is bad Iran, good Israel. I mean, it's the truth. Yet this deep dislike of Israel stems not only from Israel's alliance with America or the U.S., and the West, but also from the fact that it is a Jewish state. For the decidedly post-nationalist British left, Zionism is anathema. The idea that a people as cosmopolitan as the Jews would have set themselves on the wrong side of history by establishing a nation of their own. The Jews were once favored by the left when they were poor and widely discriminated against. But as Britain's Minister of Education, Michael Gove, has explained of the left's mentality, when Jews are successful, assertive, self-confident, or worse of all, conservative, then they move metaphorically beyond the pale. Given the way in which those such as MP Graham Morris would so casually associate the Israeli flag with the Nazis, it would appear that there is a sense of growing confidence among the anti-Israeli, Israel, and anti-Jewish fringe in Britain's parliament. But with such views flying around among the lawmakers, there must be concerns about the future diplomatic relations between the two countries. And more than that, the questions about the future of the British Jewish community become ever more troubling. Well, that's an interesting piece. Now, these Arabs are running around England dropping all kinds of money, and more of the Islamics are jumping on the bandwagon of Britain. The politicians, as usual, start shifting their alliances, mostly about money, not because of ideology or religion, because they see now maybe they can get more money out of the Islamics and the Arabs than they can the Jews. They feel they can more easily screw the Arabs than they can screw the Jews. Now, that's probably the basis of it. But the Brits have to remind themselves, or should remind themselves, it's all their fault. They're the ones that came up with the Balfour Declaration that started all this mess in North Africa. If it hadn't have been for the Balfour Declaration, the Israeli wandering Jew would have been asked to go to Uganda or some other area in Africa, which they were offered many times. Places and areas where it's, there's good agriculture and a lot of land and everything else. But no, we want the Holy Land. The Balfour Declaration has come back to haunt the British, steal everything they've got. And now it's like a heap of maggots. There's so many of them trying to get up on the next one. Jew, Gentile, Islamic, or whatever. It's just one big heap controlled by the city of London. And the left is so stupid over there, they're out in the streets wanting to fight with the the right wing skinheads and stuff, when they should be attacking the city of London. Both sides. Both sides. And that's what's the trouble with sides. I get so damn tired of labels. Everybody on all sides, so-called, uses these labels instead of talking rationally and exchanging thoughts. And I put that on a comment on a website this morning. I said, why does everybody just use labels that have been pre-digested, pre-created by the ruling class or the media or whatever, so that they come right out in any discussion with labels, calling each other labels? And that is intent on shutting off rational conversation. You don't need to do that, and you shouldn't do that, and we shouldn't do that. I mean, beyond being white separatists, what else do you need to say? Express your ideas. Why are you a white separatist? Well, tell them. Beyond that, don't deal with labels. You can tell people how you feel about the environment, how you feel about capitalists, how you feel about, in other words, the capitalists, the people with all the money, the 85 people that control trillions of dollars in this world. But both the so-called progressives and the right-wing and our right-wing racists and our left-wing racists, everybody uses these labels to call people by a label and shut off conversation. And it's planned that way. It's planned that way. I just want people to ask me a question about what I think about something. Because what you want to do is exchange thoughts, not labels. You know, when they say all these people on the progressives, and, well, a lot of other people too, neo-Nazi. What the hell does neo-Nazi mean? It doesn't mean anything. Or at least it means very little. When you label everybody that thinks racially as a neo-Nazi, you don't know what you're talking about. But starting with neo-Nazi, what the hell does that mean? Are you a National Socialist member of the National Socialist Workers' Party, of which there is none? Has it been one for, what, 70 years? Are you the neo-type? I mean, you see, these labels are all, and then all on the other side, you're saying you're a commie red bastard or something, you know. Well, do you mean he's a Marxist? Do you mean he says he believes in the Marxist way of doing things or something like that? But no, everybody leads with all these pejorative labels, and then the conversation goes into the shitter, into the crapper. And it's a problem. And that's what keeps people, good people. So let's put it this way. Racially sensitive or racially sensitive people, white people, who may have some progressive views, they may have some conservative views, but they do agree on working for the best interests of the white race. But they're kept apart by labels. And you've probably been a victim of labels. I've been a victim of labels. I'm still, no matter what I say, I'm the grand poopah of the Klan. And I haven't been in the Klan since 1980. That's over 30 years. Or I'm a neo-Nazi. I'm not a neo-Nazi. I don't even know what a neo-Nazi is. To be perfectly frank about it, I know it's a label people use to shut people up. Or a racist. Well, yeah, I'm a racial separatist. I'll accept that label. But to shut me up by calling me a racist, that's ridiculous. But most people are shut up by using the pejorative term racist. And the other side knows that. And the people, our enemies know that. Let's not say the other side. Our enemies know that. They can cut off conversation. They can cut off the exchange of ideas. He's a left winger. He's a socialist. He's a neo-Nazi. He's this and that. You see, all that's divisive. You can't exchange ideas. You can't exchange thoughts. You may not agree, but at least you'll fully understand what the other person's trying to say if you limit yourself to exchanging thoughts and my ideas. One time, I remember a media person asked me, are you this, or are you that, or are you this, or are you a Nazi? And I said, I'm Tom Metzger. That's who I am. I'm Tom Metzger. I'm not going to plead guilty to any of your labels. I should have kept it up. Point is, you can't find anything all in one spot. You can't find the whole answer to the problem in one spot. Whether it's progressive or whether it's right wing or whether conservative, you can find bits and pieces of the puzzle in all of these areas. And when you deprive yourself of seeking around into these areas, you're going to have a problem figuring anything out. Now, I get criticized because I put stuff from so-called progressives and commie bastards out. Not because that I agree with other ideas these people may have. I mean, we may be 180 degrees out on other things, but when they put out something that's the truth, if we can pretty well research it and it's a fact, and if it's something we need as weaponry, we got to use it. Just like I know I'm repeating myself. I've said this many times. And I've also said, if you're in a war and you're a frontline soldier and you lose your American rifle that was probably made in Israel, and you look around, you got no weapon, here comes the enemy, but you see an AK-47 on an enemy trooper laying dead, well, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to pick up the enemy weapon and use it. Better weapon anyhow. But the point is, you got to use the weapons where you find them and cut and paste and search around and use them. You want to look for material that will help you out, look at the enemy's material, the so-called enemy, if it is an enemy. If you want to know about Jews, read Jewish stuff. You know, of course, there's their twist to it, but there's a lot of information. The Jews like to fight. They like to fight each other. That's why they have so much trouble. Israel would have collapsed a long time ago if they'd have had peace. A lot of people would say, you're full of shit, Tom. No. Jews are the most fighting bunch of people, arguing and fighting each other, killing each other. And if they had just left them alone and ignored them, they would have collapsed a long time ago. The only thing that keeps the state of Israel together is pressure from the outside. That's all. And money from us, leeching off American white taxpayers. But they're gradually slipping, and they're slipping demographically, whereas it was a hell of a lot of white European types before, but the old white European types are dying off, and it's the non-white Sephardic types are taking over demographically. So even if Israel did not collapse on its own, it would be a just another non-white state in North Africa after a few decades. That's going to be it. I opened up my paper yesterday, my local paper, and I'm telling you, these numb nuts will drive you crazy. But it's not just here, it's all over the place. So they have a big gathering out here at the Christian College, of course. Oh, Martin Luther King was so wonderful. Martin Luther King was so great. Well, like I said, if Martin Luther King hadn't been assassinated, his name would be pretty much out of the picture today. Well, even Kennedy, he might have lost the next election. And if not, even if he won another election, if he hadn't been assassinated, he wouldn't be near the figure that he is today. I mean, you know, assassination boosts your ratings. So you want to have high ratings, get assassinated. But anyhow, like I told you before, these people don't understand Martin Luther King was a product of the State Department, not the black people. The State Department. Russia had this big program of smearing the United States all over black Africa because we had segregation over here. We hated black people. And they pushed that propaganda, pushed it. The Communist Party USA was pushing it. At the same time, they were pushing race mixing. I may be repeating myself, but I'm going to do it anyhow. The State Department was frantic to put the happy face on the Negro problem, because we are in a psychological propaganda war with the Soviets. When I talked to Leonard Patterson, who was a longshoreman, a black guy, who was a member of the Communist Party, and Julia Brown, I talked to her, a member of the Communist Party, and I think I talked to George Schuyler once, too, who had been, I believe, a member of the Communist Party. But anyhow, they said, well, our whole program was to race mix, to push race mixing. Well, maybe not our whole program, but a major part. We had the Communist Party would finance parties and liquor and broads and the whole bit, you know. But, you see, Martin Luther King was fulfilling a purpose, not a purpose really in the long run for black people. If you want a black person that was doing something pretty good for black people, it was Malcolm X. Obviously, our race doesn't agree with him, but he was doing it the way he saw fit. You know, he instigated the burning in Washington, D.C., Newark, Detroit, and several cities. Wasn't Martin Luther King. I mean, you know, they used Martin Luther King as an excuse, but they really despised Malcolm X. So anyhow, here's Martin Luther King, and okay, they got all the Jews helping him get his people down the street. And then it comes time, Vietnam War is hot and heavy, and Martin Luther King makes the mistake of getting into the Vietnam War squabble. Well, then the State Department sits down with the CIA and say, wait a minute, I think that old boy has outlived his usefulness. Now he's getting in the way. Before, he was giving us this thing about you got to love Negroes and make Negroes in Africa happy, which really, blacks in Africa don't give a shit about blacks in America, generally. And if you think they do, pick up the book Black Zion, which came out during the period just after when all these black nationalists were going back to Africa. We're going back home, boy. Well, they were treated like shit in Africa by blacks. The blacks didn't want to deal with American blacks. They want to deal with white people. So anyhow, they say, well, our brother Martin, we don't really need him anymore. He's getting in our way on this Vietnam thing. Yeah. And he's got this poor people's march going. They're liable to go bonkers and set Washington, D.C. on fire if they get some help from Malcolm X. So he gets bumped off. He was a pervert. Like I had it printed in my local paper. I knew a lady that worked in that, I forget what the hell the name of that big hotel is, and been there forever in Washington, D.C., one of the main hotels. Anyhow, I knew this woman, and she was a volunteer, and she supplied me information. She called me on the phone, said, hey, Martin's in town. What's he doing? Well, he's up in his suite upstairs partying. Drunken brawl, got the white whores up there and everything else. She'd call me every once in a while. But, you know, you could tell white people that till health freezes over, and they wouldn't believe you. Or they'd say, well, that don't matter. But if it was a white leader up there doing the same thing, I think they'd sound a little different. I think even way back in his very beginning, he was involved in criminal activity. I understand it was something to do with car theft ring or something. But anyhow, the secret is they won't put out his file. Why would this great, wonderful paragon of virtues, history, and file not be open to the public? I mean, for the people to, you know, worship and love the man, just like Obama. How come they don't let his files out? I mean, whatever files I got, they can put it out anytime they want, even if it's something critical of me. Whatever file the FBI's got, whatever the file the ATF's got, put it out there. I don't care. Put it in the New York Times, because I'm not afraid of anything that comes out in those files. But the Martin Luther King family are terrified at what's going to come out in those files. And Obama is terrified that his files, university travels and so forth, are brought out, of course. Now, why are people so stupid as not to say and demand these files be released? So anyhow, So Martin Luther King gets bumped off. Presto, hero of the century. Holidays, streets named after him, bridges named after him, everything else. That's what corruption is. That's when corruption becomes so rampant, it's insurmountable. You know, did you ever have a garbage area, a dump in your town? We used to have a dump here in town when I was a kid, and kids would go down to the dump and look around and find things to take home. Sometimes they found something pretty good. But the dump keeps getting higher and higher and higher, and the caterpillars keep trying to level it out and level it out. And after a while, the garbage gets so high and so deep that they got to go someplace else to put it. Well, that's the way politics are. The corruption becomes so deep and so high. They tell me there's places in Mexico where they got, and some other countries, they got garbage heaps so high, like a mountain. And so corruption becomes so deep and so prevalent that you got to go someplace else and start all over again. They got a neat trick, though. It's almost an allegory how they'll move from one dump and then they'll smooth it out and put dirt on top of it, and then they'll sell the property to build schools on it and stuff like that. If you'll check around where your schools are, you'll find that most of them were built on land that was not usable, a swamp or something like that. I know that's the case here. In most cases, most of the schools are built on land that wasn't that usable. So what better than a dump to build your schools on? And that evidently, that corruption, that garbage seeps right up into the classrooms and affects the brains on the kids. Allegorically. You see the allegory connection? Well, anyhow, the United States has become a dump. We can wander around in the dump and sometimes pick up some pretty good stuff that people have thrown away. But it's still a dump. It's a dump for human beings, 20, 30 million Mexicans. It's a dump for Asians, 10 or 15 million. A dump for blacks, 25, 30 million. It's just one big dump. And it's going to become so corrupt that the only way out is just to move someplace else and start a new dump. Oh, Metzger, you got to stay off the sauce. Well, I am off the sauce. I'm not drinking. I'm just drinking water. There's a book called Parkinson's Law. And you should read it sometime, Parkinson's Law. I'm sure you can find them in used bookstores. Parkinson's Law said, say you've got a company or a manufacturing institution or whatever, and people in the departments start complaining they don't have enough help. So you give a guy in one department, you give him two more assistants, and then things go along for a while pretty good, and pretty soon those two assistants start screaming, we need help. We need help. We can't handle all. And so they say, okay, and they hire two more for each one of those two assistants. And pretty soon, they've got so much wasted labor and so forth and so on that the owner says, hell with this. And the only way to do it is shut the factory down, destroy the building, plow up the ground, and start all over again. That was the basics of the book. Which is true. When something becomes so rotten and so unmanageable, the only thing to do is just walk away from it. Now, we are ideologically walking away from it. We've been walking away from it, you and me, for years. We've completely, as much as possible, walked away from it. They still call us Americans, but I don't identify with American. I don't identify with being a U.S. citizen. I identify with just being me and a white man. But that's the way it is. First, you have to ideologically and philosophically and or mentally walk away from it. Ignore it. It's going to get worse. No problem there. It's going to get worse. But you got to use whatever method you can to stay away from it. Just when I read the paper here in this small town, I read this stupid bullshit. I mean, and you say, well, what could I do to change this? Well, I don't think there's anything I can do to change this. These people are screwed up, just like they are in your community. Either religion, or drugs, or alcohol, or politics, or something. It's got them all fucked up. Try to talk to them, they're liable to stick a knife in your chest. Attack their religion? Oh, shit, you better be ready to run, man. Those peaceful, Jesus-loving Christians have been killers for centuries. And they will kill if they feel that their fanaticism is threatened. And all those people are part of the system. They're in your courthouse, they're in the, you know, even the police department, in the license bureau, wherever there's any government, is permeated with these fanatic Christian types. And all you can't separate your religion totally from your work. And so when they make laws around here, ordinances around here, many times it's based on that. They'll have sign ordinances where the one guy, his sign's okay because it's corporate authorized or the Christians like it. Another guy, there's a guy here in town put up a sign for tattoos. And you'd have thought the whole roof was caving in. Letters up the ass in the newspaper, everything. This horrible, this tattoo sign. They had big town meetings about it and everything. Finally, they come up with the fact if he'd move his sign around the side of the building, maybe make it a little smaller, we'll compromise. Compromise your ass. The guy should be able to put up whatever sign he wants to. Including naked women if he wants to. But you see, these fanatic Christians, and now we got Islamics coming in here. They drag their corruption behind them like one of these worms that leaves a trail behind them. Even like a nightcrawler. They leave this trail of stuff behind them, you know. But they control everything. And, of course, most of them are hypocrites and really atheists, most of them. But they pretend they're Christians and they pretend they're good Jesus people. But they're running all this shit. They're running the corruption. They're running the dump. That's what they're best at, running the dump. And that's what we're living in. The dump. If it's not the physical dump, it's the ideological dump. And I think the ideological dump is the worst dump to have to live in because it's mental torture to read the newspaper, it's mental torture to walk around town, it's mental torture to talk to some of these people, and it's mental torture to hear them talk politics because they never know what the fuck they're talking about. You know, this anti-Semitic stuff, or anti-Semitic stuff, has gotten so ridiculous, it's unbelievable. They go crazy. Like here, this is from Britain. Soccer player Anelka charged for anti-Semitic gesture, which was probably anti-Jew gesture. West Bromwich Albion striker Nicholas Anelka, sounds like an black African, charged by the English Football Association on Tuesday for performing a racially aggravated gesture. Considered by who? Well, I don't know. Considered to be anti-Semitic while celebrating a Premier League goal. The former France international, who faces a minimum 5-game ban under the FA's anti-discrimination sanctions, has until 8 o'clock Thursday to respond to the charge. You know, the best thing society's got is discrimination. The best thing a race has got is discrimination. After equality, discrimination is anti-discrimination is used against the race more than anything else. Second to the mystical idea of equality. I discriminate. I advocate discrimination in every part of my life. If I didn't, I'd be dead. I mean, how can an advanced society of white people accept that idea that it's bad to discriminate? How can they do that? They discriminate all the time against me. I mean, I'm not crying. I don't need their sympathy. I don't even need their money. But it depends on whose ox is being gored. But I'm 100% for discrimination. I'm glad my mom and dad were discriminating. They might not have been too aware, but I guess they were mentally aware because they inherited from their parents. Anti-discrimination. A football player makes a anti-Jew gesture. What the fuck is that? And so what if he did or she did? Every player on the football team should give the same symbol or whatever. I guess maybe this new deal that the black comedian over there in France come up with his arm signal, maybe that's going to work out. I don't know. I mean, it'll cause enough commotion that the Jews are going to have apoplexy. Of course, you young people never heard of apoplexy. They'll have strokes. The Jews are already having these strokes and they're going, oy vey, they're putting that arm thing, man, and doing it everywhere. I've even seen it taking pictures of guys in front of synagogues and so forth. Well, if that arm signal works, let's get everybody doing it. The blacks do it, the Mexicans do it, the whites do it. Let's let them all know how we feel. Pardon me, I got to get back to the funny farm. I've been gone too long and my nurse is calling me. After all, the whole country is one big insane asylum and concentration camp combined. So if you're a little nuts, they call me a nutsy, not a Nazi. I'm a nutsy. And I promise, I haven't been drinking. Well, I don't know whether this show would have made Dave Lane happy or not. Probably would. It probably would. He had a pretty good sense of humor, I believe. Anyhow, I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. That's right. And in the meantime, 14-5. Five words. Don't ever forget it. I talked to a couple of guys yesterday that were questioned by the ATF, and they said they didn't talk much, but they did talk. And I keep telling people, if you don't talk, you're going to walk most of the time. If you talk, you're going to walk yourself right into a goddamn cell. Shut up.
That ever existed is Marie Laveau down in Louisiana. A lot of weird, ungodly tales about Marie. She's supposed to have a lot of magic potions and spells and curses. Down in Louisiana, where the black trees grow, lives a voodoo lady named Marie Laveau. She got a black cat tooth and a mojo bone. Anyone who wouldn't leave her alone, she go. Jack, no good man like you all know, when he Marie Laveau. He said, Marie Laveau, you lovely witch, give me a little charm that'll make me rich. Give me $1 million and tell you what I'll do. This very night I'm going to marry you. It'll be another man done gone. So Marie done some magic and she shook a little sand. Made $1 million and she put it in his hand. Then she giggled and she wiggled and she said, hey, hey, I'm getting ready for my wedding day. But oh, a handsome Jack, he said, goodbye, Marie. You're too damn ugly for a rich man like me. Then Marie started mumbling, her fangs started gnashing, her body started trembling, and her eyes started flashing, and she went, another man done gone. Oh, if you ever get down where the black trees grow, and meet a voodoo lady named Marie Laveau, if she ever asks you to make her your wife, man, you better stay with her for the rest of your life, or it'll be another man done gone.
Now, this song goes out to all you guys, especially you young guys, but not necessarily just the young guys, who might get tripped up by some female bitch informant, like my poor buddy Dennis Mahon did. Happens over and over and over again. The feds, all kinds of police agencies use women, and it's really an abuse of women, really, but they get things on women and so forth like that, and they get them to do nasty things. Now, you listen to this song and take it to heart and learn how to handle these female agents that come around.
Won't you pour me another tequila, Sheila? Take off that red satin dress. I cross the border and I beat the dealer for all of them golden warriors. I feel like a Pancho Villa, Sheila, and I got the pesos to spend. Pour me another tequila, Sheila, and lay down and love me again. No, I can't tell you about it. Don't mind my gun by the bed. I feel kind of naked without it, but it eases the fears in my head. Just pass me the salt and the lemon, then bend down and blow out the light. I never have trusted the women, Sheila, but I'm gonna trust you tonight. You can pour me another tequila, Sheila. Take off that red satin dress. I cross the border and I beat the dealer for all the damn golden warriors. I feel like old Pancho Villa, Sheila. I sure could use me a friend. So pour me another tequila, Sheila, and lay down and love me again. Oh, Sheila, I
thing to do. You can pour me another tequila, Sheila, and I'm gonna put on your red satin dress. You put on my clothes and you go face the dealer. And Sheila, I wish you the best. I feel like old Pancho Villa. Sheila, I need a fast horse and a friend. So pour me another tequila, Sheila, and I'll ride for the border again. Yeah, pour me another tequila, Sheila, and I'll ride for the border again. Adios,
senor. Remember that song, boys and girls. Don't ever bed down with a squealer like Sheila. But if you do, ha ha, put on her red dress and make her go out and face, the music while you sink out the get out of the back door, man. They're all over the place. Squealers, snitches, informants, agents, they're everywhere. Just remember, the lone wolf that travels alone travels farthest faster.